Chapter 130. Dutiful friendship. A great annual occasion has come round in the establishment of Mr. Matthew Bagnet, otherwise Lignum Vitti, ex-artilleryman and present bassoon player. An occasion of feasting and festival. The celebration of a birthday in the family. It is not Mr. Bagnet's birthday. Mr. Bagnet merely distinguishes that epoch in the musical instrument business by kissing the children with an extra smack before breakfast, smoking an additional pipe after dinner, and wondering towards evening what his poor old mother is thinking about it, a subject of infinite speculation, and rendered so by his mother, having departed this life 20 years. Some men rarely revert to their father, but seem, in the bank books of their remembrance, to have transferred all the stock of filial affection into their mother's name. Mr. Bagnet is one of like his trait the better for that. If I had kept clear of his old girl, causes him usually to make the noun substantive goodness of the feminine gender. It is not the birthday of one of the three children. Those occasions are kept with some marks of distinction, but they rarely overleap the bounds of happy returns and a pudding. On young Woolwich's last birthday, Mr. Bagnet certainly did, after observing on his growth and general advancement, proceed, in a moment of profound reflection on the changes wrought by time, to examine him in the catechism, accomplishing with extreme accuracy the questions number 1 and 2, what is your name? And, who gave you that name, but there failing in the exact precision of his memory, and substituting for number 3 the question, and how do you like that name? Which he propounded with a sense of its importance, in itself so edifying, and improving as to give it quite an orthodox air. This, however, was a speciality on that particular birthday, and not a general solemnity. It is the old girl's birthday, and that is the greatest holiday and reddest letter day in Mr. Bagnet's calendar. The auspicious event is always commemorated according to certain forms settled and prescribed by Mr. Bagnet some years since. Mr. Bagnet, being deeply convinced that to have a pair of fowls for dinner is to attain the highest pitch of imperial luxury, invariably goes forth himself very early in the morning of this day to buy a pair. He is, as invariably, taken in by the vendor and installed in the possession of the oldest inhabitants of any coop in Europe. Returning with these triumphs of toughness tied up in a clean blue and white cotton handkerchief essential to the arrangements, he in a casual manner invites Mrs. Bagnet to declare at breakfast what she would like for dinner. Mrs. Bagnet, by a coincidence never known to fail, replying fowls, Mr. Bagnet instantly produces his bundle from a place of concealment amidst general amazement and rejoicing. He further requires that the old girl shall do nothing all day long, but sit in her very best gown, and be served by himself and the young people. As he is not illustrious for his cookery, this may be supposed to be a matter of state, rather than enjoyment on the old girl's part, but she keeps her state with all imaginable cheerfulness. On this present birthday, Mr. Bagnet has accomplished the usual preliminaries. He has bought 2 specimens of poultry, which, if there be any truth in adages, were certainly not caught with chaff, to be prepared for the spit. He has amazed and rejoiced the family by their unlooked-for production. He is himself directing the roasting of the poultry, and Mrs. Bagnet, with her wholesome brown fingers itching to prevent what she sees going wrong, sits in her gown of ceremony, an honored guest. Quebec and Malta lay the cloth for dinner, while Woolwich, serving, as beseems him, under his father, keeps the fowls revolving. To these young scullions Mrs. Bagnet occasionally imparts a wink, or a shake of the head, or a crooked face, as they made mistakes. At 1:30, says Mr. Bagnet, to the minute, they'll be done. Mrs. Bagnet, with anguish, beholds one of them at a standstill before the fire and beginning to burn. You shall have a dinner, old girl, says Mr. Bagnet. Fit for a queen. Mrs. Bagnet shows her white teeth cheerfully, but to the perception of her son, betrays so much uneasiness of spirit that he is impelled by the dictates of affection to ask her, with his eyes, what is the matter, thus standing, with his eyes wide open, more oblivious of the fowls than before, and not affording the least hope of a return to consciousness. Fortunately, his elder sister perceives the cause of the agitation in Mrs. Bagnet's breast, and with an admonitory poke recalls him. The stopped fowls going round again, Mrs. Bagnet closes her eyes in the intensity of her relief. "George will look us up," says Mr. Bagnet. "At half after four. To the moment. How many years, old girl, has George looked us up? This afternoon? Ah, lignum, lignum, as many as make an old woman of a young one, I begin to think. Just about that, and no less," returns Mrs. Bagnet, laughing, and shaking her head. "Old girl," says Mr. Bagnet, "never mind. You'd be as young as ever you was, if you wasn't younger, which you are, as everybody knows." Quebec and Malta here exclaim, with clapping of hands, that Fluffy is sure to bring mother something, and begin to speculate on what it will be. "Do you know, lignum," says Mrs. Bagnet, casting a glance on the tablecloth, and winking salt at Malta with her right eye, and shaking the pepper away from Quebec with her head, "I begin to think George is in the roving way again." "George," returns Mr. Bagnet, "will never desert, and leave his old comrade in the lurch. Don't be afraid of it." "No, lignum. No. I don't say he will. I don't think he will. But if he could get over this money trouble of his, I believe he would be off." Mr. Bagnet asks why. "Well," returns his wife, "considering, George seems to me to be getting not a little impatient and restless. I don't say, but what he's as free as ever. Of course he must be free, or he wouldn't be George, but he smarts and seems put out. He's extra drilled," says Mr. Bagnet, "by a lawyer, who would put the devil out." "There's something in that," his wife assents. "But so it is, lignum." Further conversation is prevented, for the time, by the necessity under which Mr. Bagnet finds himself of directing the whole force of his mind to the dinner, which is a little endangered by the dry humor of the fowls in not yielding any gravy, and also by the made gravy acquiring no flavor and turning out of a flaxen complexion. With a similar perverseness, the potatoes crumble off forks, in the process of peeling, upheaving from their centers in every direction, as if they were subject to earthquakes. The legs of the fowls, too, are longer than could be desired, and extremely scaly. Overcoming these disadvantages to the best of his ability, Mr. Bagnet at last dishes, and they sit down at table, Mrs. Bagnet occupying the guest's place at his right hand. It is well for the old girl that she has but one birthday in a year, for two such indulgences in poultry might be injurious. Every kind of finer tendon and ligament that is in the nature of poultry to possess is developed in these specimens in the singular form of guitar strings. Their limbs appear to have struck roots into their breasts and bodies, as aged trees strike roots into the earth. Their legs are so hard as to encourage the idea that they must have devoted the greater part of their long and arduous lives to pedestrian exercises and the walking of matches. But Mr. Bagnet, unconscious of these little defects, sets his heart on Mrs. Bagnet eating a most severe quantity of the delicacies before her, and as that good old girl would not cause him a moment's disappointment on any day, least of all on such a day, for any consideration, she imperils her digestion fearfully. How young Woolwich cleans the drumsticks without being of ostrich descent, his anxious mother is at a loss to understand. The old girl has another trial to undergo after the conclusion of the repast in sitting in state to see the room cleared, the hearth swept, and the dinner service washed up and polished in the backyard. The great delight and energy with which the two young ladies apply themselves to these duties, turning up their skirts in imitation of their mother and skating in and out on little scaffolds of pattens, inspire the highest hopes for the future, but some anxiety for the present. The same causes lead to confusion of tongues, a clattering of crockery, a rattling of tin mugs, a whisking of brooms, and an expenditure of water, all in excess, while the saturation of the young ladies themselves is almost too moving a spectacle for Mrs. Bagnet to look upon with the calmness proper to her position. At last the various cleansing processes are triumphantly completed. Quebec and Malta appear in fresh attire, smiling and dry. Pipes, tobacco, and something to drink are placed upon the table, and the old girl enjoys the first peace of mind she ever knows on the day of this delightful entertainment. When Mr. Bagnet takes his usual seat, the hands of the clock are very near to 4:30. As they mark it accurately, Mr. Bagnet announces, "George. Military time." It is George, and he has hearty congratulations for the old girl whom he kisses on the great occasion, and for the children, and for Mr. Bagnet. "Happy returns to all," says Mr. George. "But, George, old man," cries Mrs. Bagnet, looking at him curiously, "what's come to you?" "Come to me? Ah, you are so white, George, for you and look so shocked. Now don't he, Lignum?" "George," says Mr. Bagnet, "tell the old girl. What's the matter?" "I didn't know I looked white," says the trooper, passing his hand over his brow, "and I didn't know I looked shocked, and I'm sorry I do. But the truth is, that boy who was taken in at my place died yesterday afternoon, and it has rather knocked me over." "Poor creeter," says Mrs. Bagnet with a mother's pity. "Is he gone?" "Dear, dear. I didn't mean to say anything about it, for it's not birthday talk, but you have got it out of me, you see, before I sit down. I should have roused up in a minute," says the trooper, making himself speak more gaily, "but you're so quick, Mrs. Bagnet." "You're right. The old girl," says Mr. Bagnet, "is as quick as powder. And what's more, she's the subject of the day, and we'll stick to her," cries Mr. George. "See here, I have brought a little brooch along with me. It's a poor thing, you know, but it's a keepsake. That's all the good it is, Mrs. Bagnet." Mr. George produces his present, which is greeted with admiring leapings and clappings by the young family, and with a species of reverential admiration by Mr. Bagnet. "Old girl," says Mr. Bagnet, "tell him my opinion of it." "Why, it's a wonder, George," Mrs. Bagnet exclaims. "It's the beautifulest thing that ever was seen." "Good," says Mr. Bagnet. "My opinion. It's so pretty, George," cries Mrs. Bagnet, turning it on all sides and holding it out at arm's length, "that it seems too choice for me." "Bad," says Mr. Bagnet. "Not my opinion. But whatever it is, 100,000 thanks, old fellow," says Mrs. Bagnet, her eyes sparkling with pleasure and her hand stretched out to him. "And though I have been a cross-grained soldier's wife to you sometimes, George, we are as strong friends, I am sure, in reality, as ever can be. Now you shall fasten it on yourself, for good luck, if you will, George." The children close up to see it done, and Mr. Bagnet looks over young Woolwich's head, to see it done with an interest so maturely wooden, yet pleasantly childish, that Mrs. Bagnet cannot help laughing in her airy way and saying, "Oh, Lignum, Lignum, what a precious old chap you are." But the trooper fails to fasten the brooch. His hand shakes, he is nervous, and it falls off. "Would anyone believe this?" says he, catching it as it drops and looking round. "I am so out of sorts that I bungle at an easy job like this." Mrs. Bagnet concludes that for such a case there is no remedy like a pipe, and fastening the brooch herself in a twinkling, causes the trooper to be inducted into his usual snug place and the pipes to be got into action. "If that don't bring you round, George," says she, "just throw your eye across here at your present now and then, and the two together must do it." "You ought to do it of yourself," George answers. "I know that very well, Mrs. Bagnet. I'll tell you how, one way and another, the blues have got to be too many for me. Here was this poor lad. was no work to see him dying as he did, and not be able to help him. What do you mean, George? You did help him. You took him under your roof. I helped him so far, but that's little. I mean, Mrs. Bagnet, there he was, dying without ever having been taught much more than to know his right hand from his left. And he was too far gone to be helped out of that. Ah, poor creature, says Mrs. Bagnet. Then, says the trooper, not yet lighting his pipe, and passing his heavy hand over his hair, that brought up gridly in a man's mind. His was a bad case too, in a different way. Then the two got mixed up in a man's mind with a flinty old rascal who had to do with both. And to think of that rusty carbon, stock and barrel, standing up on end in his corner, hard, indifferent, taking everything so evenly it made flesh and blood tingle, I do assure you. My advice to you, returns Mrs. Bagnet, is to light your pipe and tingle that way. It's wholesomer and comfortabler, and better for the health altogether. You're right, says the trooper, and I'll do it. So he does it, though still with an indignant gravity that impresses the young Bagnets, and even causes Mr. Bagnet to defer the ceremony of drinking Mrs. Bagnet's health, always given by himself on these occasions, in a speech of exemplary terseness. But the young ladies having composed what Mr. Bagnet is in the habit of calling the mixture, and George's pipe being now in a glow, Mr. Bagnet considers it his duty to proceed to the toast of the evening. He addresses the assembled company in the following terms. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.